the more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying her habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Welcome to Voices for the Animals on KBOO Portland. This is your host, Noah Bristol. Along with Julianne Schwartz and Michelle Coppola, I bring you this show on the fourth Friday of every month at 10 a.m. Or you can listen online anytime at KBOO, that's KBOO.fm/voices for the animals. We are on the air to give voice to the urgent animal welfare and animal rights issues happening locally, regionally, and worldwide. And whether you're an animal rights activist, an online keyboard warrior, a vegan cupcake lover, an animal lover, a volunteer, or just tuning in today completely by accident and know nothing at all about any of this, you're in the right place. So before we get started with today's interview, I just want to acknowledge the current situation that's happening globally and that we're all sharing right now. And I want to wish everyone who is listening safety and security during this trying time. A global crisis like this COVID-19 pandemic is a good reminder that we are all in this together. We all inhabit the same earth, we breathe the same common air, and share a common experience. So let's look out for each other and find comfort in that solidarity. So today we are speaking with Sarah Weldon, a former hunter and now longtime animal rights activist, who among other actions has participated in Meet the Victims and worked with Vegan Outreach, a nonprofit organization working to end violence toward animals by reaching the people who are motivated enough to make changes now, and steadily increasing the number of vegans in order to reach a tipping point. Welcome to the show, Sarah. Are you there, Sarah?
Sorry, my phone was muted. I am here. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Can you start by telling us a bit about your personal history and your evolution to being an animal rights activist?
Yeah. So just like I think every vegan would say, I've always been an animal lover. It always made me really sad to see an animal in pain or suffering. I helped animals every chance I could, but like most of us, the majority of the world, I was brought up eating animals. I was taught to love animals, but also eat them. So I never made that distinction between the two. So I grew up eating animals, but also believing that I loved them very much. And it wasn't until I was taking a college English class back in April 2015, where my English professor had our class watch a documentary called The Cove. If you've heard of The Cove, it's a documentary about the dolphin slaughter that happens in Taiji, Japan. And at first, I didn't want to watch it. I was very angry when she told us that this was going to be our assignment. We were going to have to write a paper about it afterwards. Mm-hmm. And I told myself, I am not watching a documentary about dolphins getting slaughtered. Like, that is not happening. And I remember I got very angry and I went home that night and I was thinking of all of these ways of how to get out of watching this documentary. I was like, I'll tell her that, you know, I'm too sensitive to these issues. I can't watch it. And I'll request, you know, a different assignment. And if she tells me no, I'm going to go to the dean and demand that I, you know, get a different assignment.
Wow, and, a troublemaker.
Oh yeah. In my thinking, you know, all of this to myself, I was struck with this very real moment of self-reflection. And I remember sitting there thinking, who are you? What kind of person are you? What kind of person are you that you won't even open your eyes to the suffering of animals, you know? And if you don't watch this documentary, you'll have no way of knowing if there's anything you can do to help or change it. So I told myself, okay, I'll watch this film. And if it gets to be too much, I'll just excuse myself from the classroom because I knew I would cry. So I went to class the next day. I got most of the way through the film. I probably missed the last 10 to 15 minutes because I started ugly crying and it was embarrassing. So I did excuse myself and I went home that day with the question, if that is happening to dolphins in Japan, what is happening to the other animals right here in the United States that I'm eating every day? Mm-hmm. And I got on my computer and I think I spent the next 8 hours or so diving into that rabbit hole of animal exploitation, all of the ways in which we use, abuse, torture animals for money. I researched factory farming and slaughterhouses and puppy mills and animal testing, horse racing. I mean, it was just one thing led to the next. And I was disgusted and I was heartbroken and I was so confused. I couldn't believe that I think I was 26 years old at the time, and I was just now learning about all of these things. And I was just in awe that the world that I lived in, and I knew it could be bad, but I just never realized it was this bad and it was this ugly.
That sounds like dating. A really powerful transformation.
Oh my gosh, it was. And I wish I could tell you right then and there, I chose to go vegan, but my story is more complicated than that. And
sure.
I'm a little bit of ashamed, but it's just, you know, it was my journey. It was what it took for me to get to where I am.
And you used to not only participate in animal exploitation more passively, like most of us do, and just mm-hmm. purchasing the animal products, but you were a hunter as well, right?
Yeah, that's where I was going to next with the. Yeah.
Can you tell us about that dissonance?
Yes. I, you know, am a girl growing up in East Texas. My dad was always an avid hunter. I mean, his life almost revolved around hunting. And my dad, he had two girls, and I hope he never listens to this show because he would feel horrible, and I've never actually spoken to him about this, but he's made comments over the years about not having a son, and it always weighed very heavily on me as a girl and now as a woman mm-hmm. to think that I can't do the same things that boys or men can do. I felt like I had to prove myself in some way, and so for my dad, I tried to do the same things with him that a son would do. So I would go fishing with him. He took me fishing at a very early age. I think I was 13 when he took me to a father-son fishing tournament. I was the only daughter there, and I won first place. I caught the biggest bass.
Wow.
After that, yeah, he continued taking me fishing throughout my childhood, my teenage years, and then into early adulthood. And he took me hunting for the first time when I was 19. He took me turkey hunting. I used a bow, killed the turkey. Luckily, I had a very natural ability to shoot guns and weapons. So I kind of justified it. I'm able to make a clean shot. I'll make the best shot possible. This animal will die as quickly as possible and hopefully as pain-free as possible. And I can prove myself, you know, that I'm a girl. I can do this too. And you know, we have this social stigma that women are the weaker sex and that we're not capable of doing the same things that men are doing, that we're weaker, we're too emotional, you know, blah, blah, blah. And all of that just really, it made me mad that somebody could look at me and assume that I can't do something because of what sex I am. So hunting for me was partly to disprove that. I know I'm not a boy, but I can still hunt. And I wanted to show my dad, you don't need a son to do these things. I can do them with you. It was also part of the reason why I joined the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. But that's a whole other story.
I think that in our society, we certainly have an expectation that strength equals the ability to dominate or to kill.
Well, now I see a sign of strength as being able to say, no, I don't believe that killing is the answer. I don't believe that it's right. And then explaining why you believe that in the face of somebody who believes completely the opposite thing, I think that takes a lot of strength.
Though I, right? For one, admire that quality quite a lot.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I have come to admire it about myself now, but in the beginning, it was hard. It was difficult to navigate through my newfound beliefs and what I was feeling, the conflict of trying to please my dad and my new boyfriend that I had at the time, and what I truly wanted deep down, which was to be vegan. And it was hard, and I struggled with it.
You're listening to Voices for the Animals. I'm interviewing Sarah Wilton, a longtime animal rights activist. And now we're going to get into Sarah's activism that she's been participating in for the last few years and hear about some of the actions that she's been involved in. So tell us a bit about your time with Vegan Outreach. I believe you worked with them for 2 years. What is the goal of Vegan Outreach, and what was your role in that organization?
Yeah, so I came to Vegan Outreach through the Animal Rights Conference. It happens every year. And I met Yuri, who was working for Vegan Outreach, and we got to be good friends, did an internship with them in 2017 in December. And in January 2018, they offered me a paid position as an outreach coordinator. Vegan Outreach, for those of you who don't know, is a nonprofit organization, 501c3 nonprofit working to end violence towards animals. They seek a future where sentient animals are no longer exploited as commodities. That's their mission statement.
Mm-hmm. And how do they go about doing that?
They go about doing that through massive community outreach. Their biggest thing in the past have been booklets. We've got a variety of booklets that we take to college campuses and distribute them to the college students who are out and about. And then we have conversations with those students to ask them questions and try to give them information showing them that this is something that they should give a try. And then we are there to offer resources if they decide they do want to make steps towards becoming vegan. Recently, they've transitioned more to their 10 Weeks to Vegan email series, where students can sign up for this 10-week email series and get weekly tips and tricks to beginning the vegan journey. And that has cut the cost of printing so many booklets. And I think it's really good. Yeah.
And you traveled all over the country giving these leaflets to students and other people. How many do you think you passed out?
You know, my statistic is in the Vegan Outreach website, but I think I reached over 100,000 leaflets.
Congratulations. And do you have research on the effectiveness per 1,000 passed out, something like that?
They do have a vague statistic that about 1 in every 100 people who receive a leaflet will go vegan.
So that's potentially 1,000 people whose lives that you change drastically just by being there, sharing information and having conversations.
Yeah. It feels good.
Yeah, that must feel good. And now
it also feels good having those people reach out to you. Some of the people I would connect with on social media, and I've had so many send me messages telling me that they have since gone vegan, and you know, thanking me for helping change their life. So
that's fantastic.
It's been very self-rewarding.
Often we don't hear from the people whose lives that we've had an impact on, but when we do, it makes us grateful that we made the choices that we did, and we do have some power. We do have some ability to change this world.
And it also feels like it has helped make up for a lot of the mistakes that I've made in the past and the years that, you know, I caused animals to suffer, that now I'm able to pay them back in a way.
Absolutely. I have a few facts here I'd like to get your opinion on. Mm-hmm. So 6 out of 10 infectious diseases come to humans from animals, commonly through animal agriculture or the consumption of wild animals. And this includes HIV/AIDS, Ebola, SARS, and the current COVID-19 coronavirus, and MRSA, which kills 20,000 people each year in the United States alone. So what relationship is there between animal exploitation in these industries and infectious diseases in humans?
My first thought is it makes me really angry, and I feel like it's almost a form of payback. I mean, we're doing these terrible, terrible, unnecessary things to animals. I mean, complete torture, making them live in squalid, cramped cages, living in their own waste, no psychological stimulation, just living to die. And so, of course, living in these conditions, viruses, you know, they arise and they spread easily because the animals are so crammed together. And then the humans that are torturing them, you know, handle these animals, and then they pick up these viruses and diseases, and then they spread it to everybody else. And I feel like it's almost a form of payback. And I don't say that to be insensitive to the people who, you know, at first glance would feel like they're innocent. They have nothing to do with this. But I feel like we're all part of this. We create a demand for it. We allow it to happen. we don't, you know, pose any resistance when we, well, not some of us do, the people who are actively doing activism, but all of the other people out there, I feel terribly for the especially the elderly population who are getting sick from this and dying. So I don't mean to take away from that in any way, but this is a problem created by us, by humans. And I hope that this opens a lot of people's eyes to see that we need to stop doing this.
And overuse of antibiotics is a huge problem because it creates antibiotic resistant strains of these diseases like MRSA. And the majority of antibiotics that are used in this country are used on farm animals. Is that right?
I think 80%.
80%.
Yeah.
And that means that those antibiotics are less effective on humans when we need them to cure our own diseases. Isn't that right?
Because they go into the animals. The animals, you know, the antibiotics get into animals' flesh and their meat. And then we eat the meat. So every time somebody sits down and eats a piece of animal flesh, they are getting small doses of antibiotics. So small dose, small dose, small dose, you start to build up a resistance to these antibiotics. So yeah, we're setting ourselves up for failure.
And these animals need to be fed a consistent diet of antibiotics because they're living in such packed, filthy conditions that they'd be constantly sick otherwise and wouldn't make it to slaughter weight. So early in March, the Chinese government banned the consumption and farming of wild animals, which is a huge move in a nation with such a long and lucrative history of using wild animals for food and traditional medicine and pets. So what's your take on this? Do you think it will stick? And do you think that other nations will follow along?
I really hope that it sticks. I'm worried that they're only doing it right now to try to appease, you know, all of these other nations and countries who are basically attacking them for being the origin of this outbreak. And I hope that they're not just doing this temporarily to say, look, we're addressing the problem. I hope that by now, everybody realizes how severe this is and how one outbreak can lead to mass world hysteria. And now it's been labeled a pandemic. So I hope that they stick with this. I hope they realize how dangerous it is to take wild animals, keep them in cages, and you've got species mixed in together. And it's just it's a little petri dish of illnesses and bacteria and viruses. And I hope that this gets a conversation started among other nations, among other countries, and follow suit with what China is attempting to do now.
Indeed. So you have participated in a unique event that maybe some of our listeners have heard of called Meet the Victims that has happened in various countries worldwide. So can you tell us a bit about Meet the Victims generally and then your personal experience with it?
Yes. So Meet the Victims was started by a woman in Australia. And the idea is to go into these animal agriculture businesses where they try to close their doors and keep everything in the dark and not be transparent to the public, and to go in and expose what actually happens inside, to show the public what the animals actually look like, what they live in, that it's not green pastures and they're happy and healthy. So generally speaking, that's what happens. A group of activists go into a farm, housing animals, being raised for consumption, and then taking pictures, videos, and oftentimes they will negotiate when police arrive to release one or two or a few sick animals that are surely going to die. So that's generally what Meet the Victims is. They want the public to meet the victims of their food choices.
And usually activists move in mass so that they have the power in numbers and put their own personal safety at risk as a bargaining tool, right? To fight for the rights of these animals and the rights of the public to know what's going on in these places that produce their food, quote unquote. And so you participated in one that happened in Texas, right?
Yes. It was a smaller scale Meet the Victims. I think we had, I don't think we reached 100 activists. It was less than 100, and over half of those people stayed outside of the facility. So I think there were roughly 40 to 50 of us who went inside of this chicken barn in Gonzales, Texas. About, I think it was about 40 to 50 of us actually went into this chicken barn where there were baby chicks to show people what these chicks are going through, what they live in, the conditions, and then the state of the baby chicks themselves. So the 40, 50 of us, how many of us there were, went inside, and we put on the proper gear. We had hazmat suits and gloves. And I want to note that when we walked onto the property, the gate was open. There was a sign that said no trespassing, but it was hidden behind a tree or some bushes or something. It wasn't clearly visible. The gate was open. So we walked onto the property. The door to the chicken barn was open. It was not locked, so we didn't do any breaking and entering. We didn't steal anything. We simply walked onto an open property and took pictures and video. I don't remember how many chicks we found that were already dead, but some of the bodies of the chicks looked to be, you know, they had been decomposing for at least a few days, if not a few weeks. Like, these people were not concerned with walking around and picking up the bodies of the chicks that were already dead. And I mean, I think that's you're just asking for disease to start spreading. You've got live chicks walking around the dead bodies of other chicks. And all of the chicks that were in the process of dying, whose legs or wings or bodies were messed up in some way, they couldn't walk to water or food, who were slowly going to starve to death. And it was just such a heartbreaking sight to see in this barn. Industrial sized, it was so big. It was, I don't know how big a football field is, but I'm going to say it was at least the size of one football field. And as far as I could see, a sea of yellow, fluffy baby chicks. And the smell, take your breath away, burned your eyes from the ammonia. And it was just, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. So we took our pictures and our videos, and I think we were inside the barn for maybe an hour. And we came out, and as we were coming out, the owners of the farms had finally realized what was going on, and they went and called the police. And the police arrived on site, and I was one of the last few people to be crossing from private property to public property, and the police came and stopped us. He put his hand up, and he said, "Whoa, whoa, you know, we could arrest you for trespassing." And me and about three other people said, "We know, we're sorry, we're leaving." And the police said, okay, and they let us go, and they let us stand on the side of the road with signs and peacefully protest for the next hour or so. Mm-hmm. And then we all left and went home. And it wasn't until 3 weeks later, after we had shared a lot of things on social media, a lot of the pictures and videos and personal accounts of what had happened on social media, that we learned that some of the activists had warrants issued for their arrest. And I learned that I was one of those people who had a warrant, because I had shared a very lengthy video pretty much breaking down everything that had happened. So what had happened was the farm owners had gone on social media. They saw what we shared. And so they took note of all of the people who were easily identifiable being inside of the barn. So when I found out, I turned myself in, got fingerprinted, spent a few hours in jail, then was released, hired a lawyer, all of that good stuff. And eventually we all stood before the judge and were sentenced with Class B misdemeanors for criminal trespassing. And I am now on probation for the next year, hopefully 6 months, if they decide to let us off early.
Well, congratulations on that. And, and thank you for having the courage to put your personal safety at risk in order to expose the truth and help not only those animals, but also the people who don't yet realize that they're participating in a system like that. I know that most people would be taken aback to think that, like, why would there be so many dead chicks among the living? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't the farmers have a vested interest in keeping these animals alive until they reach slaughter weight? But
you would think that.
Isn't it right that this happens because it's more economical to produce these beings in mass and there's an acceptable death rate as long as they're able to bring the majority of those animals to full weight by the time that they're meant to be slaughtered?
Yeah. What people need to understand is that, like you said, it's more economical to raise them in mass. So you've got these huge industrial sized sheds housing sometimes tens of thousands of chicks. So if you've got 10,000 chicks, you know, say 10% they're going to die, whatever their percentage rate, death rate is. And it's just, you know, accepted as part of business. But what really makes me angry is that if it had been another species of animal, say those had been puppies or kittens instead of chicks, the farm owners would be the ones in prison for felony animal cruelty, instead of the whistleblowers, the activists who are trying to show the world that, hey, this isn't right. Yes, these are chicks. They're considered, you know, food animals, but they're no different from the puppies or the kittens that we love at home. So it just blows my mind how the species of animal can determine who is the criminal and who gets away. It makes me angry.
Indeed. And there are some minimal protections for some farm animals, such as pigs and cows, but those protections generally do not extend at all to avian species, which are the majority of animals farmed and killed in the United States.
That is why Vegan Outreach has the chicken, as kind of like their mascot, to bring up that point that chickens and other avian species have basically zero protections. So basically you could do whatever you want to a chicken on a farm and it be totally legal.
So we've come to the end of our time. Is there anything else that you'd like people listening to know, Sarah?
There's a lot, but I guess I'll leave people with the thought that you as one person have so much power and influence. If you make changes, if you open your heart and, you know, put that compassion out there to all beings, to people, animals, other people will see that. They will notice that. And eventually they'll ask you about it. They might be resistant at first, but if you're patient and loving and try to be as non-judgmental as possible. I know it's hard in the beginning when you first find out all of these facts and what the animals are going through. It's really easy to point the finger at other people and say, you're doing this, this is wrong, you're hurting animals. But remember that we are all raised in a society that makes those things normal. And for people like me who are raised in families where certain things are the norm and accepted, like hunting, it can be really hard for those people to step out of that, especially if they're brand new and they don't have a support system. So just try to be as loving and compassionate to everybody, especially yourself. I think a lot of times we battle with ourselves because our moral beliefs and our actions are not in alignment. We all say that we love animals. We don't want animals to be hurt. But then, you know, we turn around and we eat animals, or we go to the zoo, or we go to a circus, or we buy a product that was tested on animals. And when our moral beliefs and our actions aren't in alignment, it causes a lot of distress within us, causes us to be at war with ourselves, like I was for so many years. So be compassionate with everybody, yourself, and just try to always put yourself in the other person, the other animal's place, and think, if I were them, what would I want to have happen to me?
Thank you for sharing that with us, Sarah. And thank you for joining me today. This has been Noah Bristol with Voices for the Animals, speaking with Sarah Weldon. Voices for the Animals airs at 10 a.m. on the fourth Friday of every month, or you can listen online anytime at kboo.fm/voicesfortheanimals. Until next time.